Siegfried von Westerburg actually had no chance of becoming Archbishop of Cologne. In November 1274, the Cologne Cathedral chapter elected Konrad von Berg almost anonymously. 9 votes in favor of Konrad, 1 in his favor, Siegfried. The race seemed decided. But Siegfried did not give up. He staked everything on a card that nobody in the Cologne Archbishopric had in mind, an ace up his sleeve, so to speak, who was far away from the Rhineland, in the French city of Lyon. So he set off on his journey. A ride that would not only change his own future, for what began here as a nobleman daring ride to Lyon would lead us to the fields south of Worringen 14 years later. In the decisive Battle of Worringen, though, it all started really well and, above all, peacefully. How Siegfried von Westerburg managed to become one of the most powerful men in the empire, and why Cologne was given a beautiful new Gothic city seal, all right after the intro. Engelbert von Falkenburg died on 24th October 1274. What a shambles he had left behind. When he took office in 1261, he had been given a city of Cologne that was almost completely subject to him. And then, within the 13 years of his reign, he had messed up almost everything with the inhabitants of Cologne. Uncompromisingly and clumsily, he relied above all on violence. He was imprisoned twice during his reign, the first time for a few weeks, then in 1268 for 3 years, by his own subject, the Count of Jülich. In the end, the citizens of Cologne, led by the Overstolzen family and their allies, stood united against him, united by the common struggle against the once most powerful and now expelled family of the wise men from the Mühlengasse, who had fraternized with the Archbishop. When a reconciliation was finally reached in 1271, the Archbishop had to realize that he no longer had much to say in the city itself, even if he remained a powerful imperial prince outside the city walls of Cologne. And what a prince he was. With the coronation of Rudolf von Habsburg by him in 1273, the Archbishop of Cologne made a significant contribution to an end of the so-called interregnum, the chaotic period of never fully recognized royal elections that had prevailed since 1250 when the last Hohenstaufen, Frederick II, died. But oh horror, the new ruler Rudolf of Habsburg was an outspoken friend of cities in his empire, which also favored Cologne, but we'll come to that in a moment. So, when Engelbert von Falkenburg died in October 1274, there was a certain amount of unrest in the Cologne Cathedral chapter. Who could best fulfill this powerful position? Two candidates crystallized. Konrad von Berg, indeed those von Berg who gave their name to the Bergische Land to the east of Cologne and have already received their own podcast episode in this podcast, and Siegfried von Westerburg. However, the search for a successor quickly turned into a veritable election chaos. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old. I am Willem, and I am your tour guide through the chronology of Cologne's history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. In November 1274, the Cologne Cathedral chapter met to vote on the new archbishop. Where did they meet? Not in Cologne, as one might logically assume, because the city had been under the interdict for years, a favorite weapon of the archbishops and Engelbert von Falkenburg in particular to exert pressure on Cologne. The resulting ban on all religious acts, including burials, marriages, and baptisms, was devastating for a society that saw itself and its environment as thoroughly steeped in religion. As a result, the election of the archbishop, also a religious act, could not take place in Cologne. So, neighboring Bonn was chosen, which lies to the south of Cologne and has increasingly become the alternative seat of the archbishops of Cologne. Disclaimer foreshadowing. The cathedral chapter quickly came together for the election. This was because they feared that the Pope might interfere in the election of the Bishop of Cologne. And they were not entirely wrong. At the time, the Pope was in Lyon, France, and he diligently wrote letters to all those involved stating that he wanted to claim the right to appoint the new chief shepherd of Cologne. However, by the time the letters arrived in the Rhineland, the Cologne Cathedral chapter had quickly established the facts. They already selected 10 electors from their own ranks to make the decision. They chose 9 normal cathedral canons and, of course, the head of the cathedral chapter, the cathedral provost. The result of the election was as already known. The 9 cathedral canons all voted for Konrad von Berg, who was the provost of neighboring St. Maria Graden, the church directly adjacent to Cologne Cathedral. Only the 10th member of this electoral body, the provost of Cologne Cathedral, decided in favor of Siegfried von Westerburg, which was an interesting choice, but why actually? In the meantime, all the members of the Cologne Cathedral chapter were from the high nobility, with very rare exceptions from time to time. Siegfried von Westerburg was also from the high nobility, even if you look at it a little loosely, from the Rhenish high nobility. But from that part of the Rhineland that was more orientated towards the Archbishopric of Mainz, the land of Siegfried's family, where in the Westerwald region and on the Lahn River. In other words, from what is now Hesse and Rhineland Palatinate. I don't know how to pronounce that German state in English. Sorry. He was therefore also, so Siegfried, the provost of Mainz Cathedral, and thus already one of the most powerful people in the Archbishopric of Mainz. And typically for this time, Siegfried had also amassed other church offices that came with lucrative benefices and power. At the same time, he was not only a full-time cathedral provost in Mainz, he was also a member of the Cologne Cathedral chapter. That was just the way it was. That would no longer be possible today. So, this election that took place in Bonn here on 15th November 1275 was pretty clear-cut, with 9 out of 10 votes going to Konrad von Berg, 90% so to speak. Only 1 in favor for Siegfried von Westerburg, 10%. So Konrad would be the new archbishop, right? Well, I won't keep you in suspense. You already know from the intro, Siegfried did not give up. He set off on the long journey to Lyon to speak to the Pope there himself. Pope Gregory X was naturally furious that a decision had been made in the Rhineland over his head. He proclaimed that the election decision in favor of Konrad von Berg was invalid. And what a miracle! The ideal candidate, who was loyal to the Pope, had already traveled to him. He, the Pope, personally appointed Siegfried von Westerburg as the real new Archbishop of Cologne. And you know, in these times, honor and public action is everything in a time when there was no newspapers, television, photos, or the internet. Not just any bishop consecrated Siegfried as a bishop, no, Pope Gregory X himself. That was supposed to give the whole thing even more oomph. Which was probably effective. He received the pallium, the Pope's badge of honor, which you wrap around your torso as an archbishop like a scar, on his way to Cologne. Practical, because then as now, you usually have to travel to Rome for the first time as a newly elected archbishop after the election in order to receive it. So, 2 birds with 1 stone. Konrad von Berg, now surprisingly the losing candidate in the election, was naturally not all pleased with this papal decision, and his brother, the Count of Berg, Adolf V, would emerge as a particular future opponent of Siegfried von Westerburg right up to the fields near Worringen in 1288. Who was Siegfried von Westerburg and what challenges did he face at the beginning of his reign in 1275? As you already know, he came from a noble line near the River Lahn with its ancestral seat at Runkel Castle in Hesse. It is not known exactly when he was born, probably around 1235. This means he was around 40 years old when he was elected. He became cathedral provost of Mainz in 1259 as his relative, Werner von Epstein, was elected the new Archbishop of Mainz. This meant that Werner's previous post as provost of Mainz Cathedral became vacant. Convenience, isn't it? It is not known when he secured his seat in the Cologne Cathedral chapter with the lucrative benefices, so income from the properties of the Cologne Cathedral Monastery. But what is known is that he fought on the side of his predecessor, Archbishop Engelbert von Falkenburg, in several battles. As for example, the battle near Zülpich in 1267, and Siegfried, also like his boss, ended up behind bars for several weeks and years. What I keep forgetting, but want to make clear to you, unlike today, the archbishops of the time were not usually only theologians. No, not really. They were high nobles. They were washed in all kinds of water, as we say in German. The fact that Siegfried, like his predecessor, personally fought in battles showed above all that they were practiced in the art of war as knights and knew how to hold their own in battles. And they were used to the accompanying symptoms such as fear, hunger, cold, fatigue, and so on. At least that's what the Cologne Bishop's Chronicle says about Siegfried von Westerburg. Siegfried von Westerburg's start in office was not really an easy one, as we already know. Although he had prevailed in the election, he certainly still had to warm a few hearts in the Cologne Archbishopric. He was thus suddenly one of the most powerful imperial princes of his time, but his predecessor, Engelbert, had left behind shambles. The residential city of Cologne, which gave its name to the Archbishopric of Cologne and the secular possessions, had fought fiercely with both of Siegfried's predecessors. Even though his direct predecessor Engelbert was dead, the interdict continued to apply to the city. The situation was also precarious in other parts of his dominion. The vassals of the Archbishop of Cologne had long pursued their own territorial policy and aimed to restrict the Archbishop of Cologne as the most powerful ruler in the northwest corner of the empire, be it the County of Berg, the County of Jülich, or the Duke of Brabant. Throughout the Rhineland and Westphalia, the Archbishop's secular power was under enormous pressure from outside and within. How would Siegfried react to all these dangers and challenges, or take actions against them? With heavy-handed violence like his predecessor? No, not at all. Siegfried was not without violence in his early years, but he was much cleverer in his tactics and actions. And what can I say, people? If I had been his political advisor at that time, I could hardly have given him any better advice on how to act, with a few exceptions, and the knowledge I have from today's perspective. The new ruler of the Holy Roman Empire, Rudolf I of Habsburg, was an avowed supporter of the cities in his empire. This also applied to the city of Cologne and its wealthy political leading inhabitants. A few weeks after Engelbert's death, and thus before Siegfried was elected as the new Archbishop of Cologne, Rudolf I issued generous privileges to the city of Cologne. On 8th November 1274, he proclaimed trading privileges in the empire for Cologne merchants and promised to stand rock solid by Cologne's side to protect their goods and chattels. He formulated this explicitly in the document, to help Cologne should the archbishop or an external opponent attack the city unjustly. It almost reads as if Cologne was a free city under the direct control of the king, which it was not. The Archbishop of Cologne is the city lord still, the head of the city. It really sounded like a potential disruptive factor in this relationship, the Archbishop, who should be put in his place if necessary, which it's nonsense because he really still is de jure the head of the city. Rudolf I did not do this without ulterior motives, of course. He had recognized that cities could be used as a means of power for the king against powerful imperial nobility. It was hoped that this would prevent the ever-dwindling royal power in the empire, making the Holy Roman Empire the joke that it is, according to so-called internet historians, which is totally nonsense. But let's not continue on that topic. How successful this was, keeping the Imperial power, however, is not a part of our discussion here anyways. An Engelbert might have responded with another desperate ill-considered action. But what did Siegfried von Westerburg do when he heard of that? He took it in his stride, and he went much further. Not only did he recognize the royal privilege for Cologne, but when he took office in the early summer of 1275, on 2nd June 1275 to be precise, he lifted all the church punishments, including the interdict that was given to the city by his predecessor, as a sign of goodwill. This meant that after 7 long years, religious acts were officially possible again. This included those acts that still affect our everyday lives today: baptisms, weddings, funerals, and church services in general. The new archbishop really made up ground with the people of Cologne with that. On 5th June, however, Siegfried went even further. The archbishop and the city conclude a treaty of friendship, an alliance that was to last until 1288. Unusual, such a long period of peace between the rich citizens and the city rulers. They had already met as equals in the small and great arbitration in recent years, this time, however, under more peaceful conditions and above all to the advantage of both sides. As is typical for such agreements, the old rights were confirmed for the city. Already well known to us here is a non-extradition of Cologne citizens to foreign courts, customs and trade privileges, and that as a citizen of Cologne you cannot be imprisoned for the debts of the archbishop. In other words, everything that the citizens of Cologne had been fighting for step by step since 1074. The city of Cologne, in turn, gave the city lord the assurance that they regarded him as the supreme judge and lord of the city. That sounds good. Both sides assured each other of the other's rights and defined their boundaries. Within the city, too, everything remained as usual. The Collegiate of Magistrates, which was actually a municipal body sworn to the archbishop in the first place, was still allowed to decide for themselves who they would accept into their midst, keeping the archbishop out of this decision. This naturally suited the Oberstolzen and their allies, who thus had a free hand there. While Konrad von Hochstaden, Siegfried von Westerburg's predecessor, had forcibly broken up the minting cooperative and placed it under his direct control, they were now once again independent in minting coins again. His coins, the archbishop's coins. And also to manage themselves internally. And what was really extraordinary, the archbishop allowed the city to continue appointing non-Cologne citizens as new citizens. In the recent past, this was a favorite means of Cologne's patricians to win over foreign nobles, such as the Count of Jülich, as allies, making them citizens of Cologne, and thus giving them the obligation to defend the city. Speaking of the Count of Jülich, the Oberstolzen and their allies had worked well with him, the Count of Jülich. Two archbishops of Cologne had already been imprisoned at his castle in Nideggen. However, this does not mean that the alliance of convenience between Jülich and Cologne did not always run smoothly. During the conflict against Engelbert von Falkenburg, Count William IV of Jülich took advantage of this situation and built a castle directly in the north of Cologne, an illegal castle. It has always been the aim of the neighboring rulers here on the Rhine to expand towards the Rhine River and then secure this with castles. The Count of Berg did this, as did the Count of Jülich. Worringen was actually the direct territory of the Church of Cologne, so, as I said, an illegal castle was built here by Jülich. This was naturally a thorn in the side of the Archbishop of Cologne, now being Siegfried von Westerburg from 1275 on. But it was not only him, but also the Cologne patricians who were bothered by the fact that the castle was standing there. A castle that could affect and threaten the important and sensitive and lucrative trade on the Rhine River and on the overland route to the north, so towards the Lower Rhine, the Netherlands, and even the North Sea and England. The cunning Siegfried recognized the potential here. You know my old saying, Cologne is always flexible when it comes to loyalty, and they proved that this time too. On 29th November 1276, the Archbishop issued a document to the citizens of Cologne in which he assured them that he, the Archbishop of Cologne, would destroy Jülich, the castle of Jülich near Worringen, if it fell into his hands. How do you conquer a castle? You've probably seen it in many films where siege engines and assaults are used in an attempt to simply conquer the castle in a storm. But from a military tactical point of view, that's a pretty stupid idea. Many of your soldiers would die in a direct attack on a castle. So the Archbishop did something that was often done when a castle was bothering you. You just built another castle, your castle, right next to it. A so-called counter-castle. Once this had been built, this counter-castle, it was used to wrest power from the actual castle in the region. For example, to bombard or siege it from here. There were now two castles in Worringen, to the north of Cologne, standing next to each other. But here too the Archbishop promised, in the same document from November 1276, that he would demolish his own castle as soon as the castle of the Count of Jülich had been conquered. Please, you have to remember that. That will be very important. But Siegfried von Westerburg also had foreign policy concerns, as already mentioned. Many of the actual vassals of the Church of Cologne were openly hostile to him, be it Jülich, Berg, the Landgraf of Hesse, or the Bishop of Paderborn even. However, Siegfried also skillfully forestalled this by forging alliances with the other archbishops of Mainz and Trier and the Bishop of Münster. In my opinion, as I said, Siegfried of Westerburg had done many things right as the new Archbishop of Cologne. He had secured himself as well as possible in terms of domestic and foreign policy. And now he could pursue politics in peace as he pleased, and he did. At first, he turned against this troublesome castle of the Count of Jülich in the north of Cologne near Worringen. In autumn of 1277, the Archbishop's troops marched to the castle of Jülich in Worringen together with troops from Cologne containing Cologne citizens. So the Archbishop of Cologne and Cologne citizens are working together here. After just a few days, the people of Cologne succeeded in taking the castle by the Count of Jülich. On 12 October 1277, the citizens of Cologne diligently started to destroy the Jülich castle with tools and whatever they used for that. However, when they tried to do the same on the counter castle by the Archbishop refused. He said, "No, I want to keep my castle. What do you think you do here?" So, in doing so, the city ruler of Cologne broke one of the key promises he had made to the citizens of Cologne 2 years earlier in 1275. This did not break the whole Treaty of Friendship. It was to last, as I said, until 1288. But this action left the people of Cologne with a bitter aftertaste. An aftertaste that would not be forgotten. If Siegfried had realized what consequences this would have for him, he might have reconsidered whether it was the right decision. But let's not get ahead of ourselves here. Let's move on to one of the most beautiful auxiliary signs of history science, stragistics, meaning the study of seals. And I don't mean the animals, I mean the document thing. After a short break for a drink, my throat is really dry. Do you remember the Battle of the Ulrepforte in 1268? The battle between the Weisen von der Mühlengasse in alliance with the Archbishop Engelbert von Falkenburg on the one side against the Overstolzen, the allied patrician families, and the Cologne guilds on the other. And do you know what preceded that battle? That's right, the wise man from the Mühlengasse who had set the tone so far in the 13th century had stolen the city seal. In other words, the stamp for making the city seals. And then they never returned it. And when they were driven out of the city, out of Cologne, the city seal no longer existed or appeared again. Not at all. Not even until today, it is lost to us. A real problem already back then in 1268, because without a seal, Cologne was practically incapable of acting in the 13th century. So a new city seal was needed, and what can I say, folks? It's really beautiful. Thanks to Julia, by the way, who sent me replicas of the Cologne city seal by post some time ago, I was able to have a direct look at it. I will, of course, put photos of them on my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. Seals. As I said, not meaning the animals, which are cute, by the way. Seals are much more than just pretty stamps. Medieval seals have even been described by some as the microcosm of culture in the Middle Ages, because so much can be learned from them. Production techniques, the history of ideas, iconography, self-image, legal concepts, and above all, artistic concepts. But this does not only apply to the Middle Ages. Seals cannot be minimized in the history of mankind. Seals are older than the invention of writing. Between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers in Mesopotamia, seals were already used many, many thousand years ago as a means of identification long before a writing system was developed there. Similarly, in ancient Egypt, seals were used to seal or authenticate something or goods. In the Rhineland, seals first came into fashion 2,000 years ago with the Romans. Through constant exchange, the Germanic peoples that later took over in the region here then also adopted seals. But, well, this is the Middle Ages. For a long time, only kings and popes had seals. Then also bishops, dukes, and rich monasteries. And now, also important cities like Cologne for quite some time. So seals are very important here. They allow you to negotiate with the powerful on an equal footing. Above all, if the city wants to negotiate contracts with other cities, rulers, or even the archbishop, you simply need a seal. I cannot get that image out of my head that I'm talking about the animal. Just like the good old company stamp at your work, a seal is. You pour hot liquids, wax somewhere, press the stamp in it with the seal stamp, and the seal is thus created. Only then is a document legally valid. The old Romanesque city seal of Cologne, which was created around 1114, the stamp, had been lost, as I said. A new seal stamp was created here after 1268, this time with a Gothic motif. And oh boy, it has survived to this day, thankfully. It is now in the possession of the Cologne City Museum, and is considered by many researchers to be one of the most aesthetically beautiful city seals ever. I personally cannot judge that. For that, I would have to have seen all the city seals that have ever existed. I just rely on this scientific sentence. What does a city seal have to offer? It must be designed in such a way that it is as difficult as possible to forge. This means that the highest artistic standards had to be met. Who could produce such a seal? It was mainly goldsmiths. And one or more goldsmiths in Cologne produced a new Gothic city seal in 1268. So, let's take a look at it. What can we actually see on it? As I said, picture of that is on my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. We are mainly talking now about the front side, so the positive side of the city seal. Just like in the previous Romanesque city seal, St. Peter is sitting on a throne surrounded by a city wall and protected by a Gothic canopy, an ornamental roof. Which city wall can be seen here? Of course, you might think that St. Peter is sitting here in the seal within Cologne's city wall. Logically enough, people are proud to have the largest medieval city wall in Europe in Cologne, which no external enemy has yet been able to overcome. That would be one explanation. But I don't think another explanation is entirely wrong either. The wall here that we see here could be the city wall of heavenly Jerusalem. The wall depicted here on the seal is, including the tower and city gates, it hardly resembles the city wall of Cologne, which makes you wonder, because the Cologne goldsmith who created the seal in 1268 could have inquired about this directly on site, just leaving his working shop. Cologne, as a replica of heavenly Jerusalem, That theory is not far-fetched. It was not for nothing that Cologne had 12 land-side city gates built into its own city wall from 1180 onwards. This high number of city gates was completely oversized for the time and militarily unnecessary or weak points. Later on, some of the unneeded city gates would no longer be opened or would be walled up completely. Above all, the Ulrepforte gate, which was converted into a windmill in the late Middle Ages, is an example of that. So, now, if you wanted to get out of the south of Cologne, you had to go through the Severance Gate. So, let's summarize. The seal shows St. Peter sitting on a throne under a canopy and surrounded by a city wall. Around this circular seal, similar to the old 5 D-mark coin, maybe one of the older ones surely will remember who paid with the D-mark currency in Germany before 2002. Maybe you remember that. But there is a lettering written in Latin around the seal. And what can I say? It sounds really sexy from the sound of it. Quote, Sancta Colonia, Dei Gratia Romanae, Ecclesiae Fidelis Filia. End quote. Meaning, translated into modern English, Holy Cologne, by the grace of God, faithful daughter of the Roman Church. If this saying doesn't represent the self-image of medieval Cologne, then I don't know what does. The Church alone did not claim this sanctity. Even the city and thus its inhabitants and secular institutions saw themselves closely associated with the term of being holy. The two words Sanctus Petrus also hover over St. Peter himself in the seal. I don't think I need to translate what that means now. The size of the city seal also says something about the city's own self-confidence. As I said, it is round and has a diameter of 10.9 centimeters. For you Americans, that's 4.3 inches. This makes it one of the largest city seals ever. And as I said, if you want to have a look at it, just check out my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. Often less considered in research and literature is the negative side, the reverse side of the seal. This was a way of preventing the seal from being misused or forged. From a technical point of view, it would not be difficult to remove the seal if it only had one side, which was attached to a parchment document with several cords, and simply attach it to a new forged document, making it look like official and legal. It has happened, believe me. Forged documents are as old as documents themselves. The purpose of the counter seal was to prevent this, these forgeries. When a seal was affixed to a document, the positive side was used at the front and the counter seal was used at the back. This meant that a genuine seal could not simply be removed and affixed to another forged document, because the counter seal would then be missing or break even. However, the counter seal was much smaller and more modest in design. It was only 4.4 centimeters, so I guess 1 inch, in diameter and also circular. St. Peter is also depicted here, but only as a half figure, virtually from the waist up. But there is no city wall and no roof over his head. It's still had an inscription, but unlike on the obverse, it was very sober and bureaucratic, saying Sanctus Petrus contra sigillum civitatis coloniensis, so meaning St. Peter, counter seal of the city of Cologne. Here too, the seal stamp has been preserved and is in the possession of the Cologne City Museum. So, dear people, that was another real nice episode, I think. Let's leave it at that for today. What's next on the agenda? Well, I've been avoiding it for a long, long time, but here it is, what the event in medieval Cologne was, or at least what is regarded as such. If that's really true, we have to find out. It is the Battle of Worringen in 1288. You've already learned what Worringen is in this episode. But it would be a shame to just present the battle as such and then simply continue. I would like to make a kind of mini podcast series on the Battle of Worringen. In addition to the typical political and historical background, I would like to go into so much more, like fashion, types of weaponry, the motives of the parties involved, which were simply the entire northwest of the empire back then, what flags and coats of arms were used, what was the historical reception of the battle in the immediate aftermath, but also well into the 19th century, and then, of course, a look at pop culture as well. After all, anyone who grew up or was socialized in Cologne will have heard of this battle at least once. But I wonder whether most people in Cologne even know where Worringen is today. And that, dear people, takes preparation and time. Fortunately, I already have all the literature I need. Thanks also to the great support from the History Podcast Bubble that helped me out here. But I need time for that. Because, adding to that, I also need some time elsewhere soon as well. I'm going to be a father for the first time in a few weeks. And I will need the time so that we can get to know each other as a young family. So I regret to inform you that there will be no podcast episodes for at least January and February 2026. On the other hand, I am personally looking forward to spending this new and intense time with my young, small family, and not being in the usual hamster wheel of having to make a new podcast episode every 3 weeks. And when the podcast resumes in March 2026, you will be well entertained with the Battle of Worringen. I hope and count on your understanding, and you still will support this podcast by give it a listen. So in all likelihood, unless the next generation decides to come a little earlier, 15th December 2025 will be the last day until March 2026, when a new podcast episode will be released. What did I use as literature for this episode? Firstly, the classics, Karl Dietmar and Hugo Stehkemper's Cologne in the High Middle Ages. Then works by Toni Diederich, the expert in seal studies. One is his lecture from 9th November 2009 in the Museum Schnütgen, in German, zur Bedeutung des Siegelwesens in Köln und im Rheinland, so meaning the importance of seals in Cologne and the Rhineland, which is available as a printed booklet in German. On the other hand, his scientific article on the Gothic city seal in the book Quellen zur Geschichte der Stadt Köln Band 1, meaning historical sources for the history of the city of Cologne, Volume 1, published by the Förderverein Geschichte in Köln, a great organization I've been a member since long before I started podcasting that explores Cologne's history. Many thanks this time to Klaus, Brigitte, Jürgen, Edith, Beatrix, Norbert, Antje, Christian and Andreas for your tips via PayPal. Recommend me, rate this podcast wherever there are podcasts, and auf Wiedersehen.